All right, I invite you to turn with me to James chapter 3. We're doing a study in Sunday school on the book of James. And this here in James chapter 3 is one that a lot of times we'd probably rather skip. You know, there's some topics that you'd rather skip over if you are just kind of being selective. It's kind of like the way you wanted to eat at the Thanksgiving get-together. If you get together with family, you pretty much know who fixed what, you know, what you like, what you don't really like. The rule at our house was always if mom put it on our plate, we had to eat it. But at Thanksgiving, you know, or a big thing like that, thankfully she didn't give me some of everything. So my South Georgia grandma would have pickled beets. They're available. I was never forced to eat that, for which I'm thankful. But, you know, when it comes to going chapter by chapter, you know, passage by passage through a study of the Scriptures, we don't just get to pick and choose. And the reality is that, you know, you can pick and choose what you want to read, I guess, and you can try to selectively obey, but that doesn't get us out of accountability, does it? It doesn't absolve us of the responsibility. So we finished up last week in James chapter 2 talking about the fact that faith and works are inextricably linked. You cannot have one without the other. Works do not replace faith, do not bring salvation, but a faith that is alive will produce works, just like a root that is alive will produce shoots coming out of the ground. And so then there's kind of a subject change when we roll over into James chapter 3, all right? So we're going to be looking at the topic of the tongue. And I invite you to read with me James chapter 3. We'll read verses 1 through 4, and then we'll see how far we get if we go beyond that. But James 3, verse 1, "My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths that we may obey, excuse me, that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth." So we see here in verses 1 and 2, the perfect man. And then, you know, we see that thought rolls over into a discussion on the tongue. But verse number 2, it describes a perfect man. It said, if a man can meet these conditions, he is a perfect man. That word perfect is the same word that's used in James chapter 1 and verse number 4 where it says, let patience have her perfect work. The word means complete or entire. And speaking of a person, it speaks of bringing to a point of complete maturity. Okay, so the perfect man is not sinless, but rather a mature man, a well-developed believer. But to lead into that, in verse number 1, there's a caution, my brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. The word master there is the word for teacher. It's not the word rabbi, it's a different word, but it's a word for teacher. Be not many teachers. In other words, don't desire to put yourself up there, and there's a reason given, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. That word condemnation there has the idea of judgment. It's not like, you know, being, you know, condemned to the death penalty necessarily, but rather it's the pronouncement of a judge. It's the official decision to be found guilty or to be pronounced, to have an official pronouncement from the judge. So the truth here is this, that those who teach, those who are, if I could say it this way, in a place of leadership, have a greater condemnation. In other words, will be judged more intently. Okay, it's a greater responsibility. Those who are in a, you know, visible position, you know how that works. People will watch the preacher, especially to see, all right, this is what he's preaching. Does he do what he says? They'll watch the preacher to see if he does how he responds in a certain situation, knowing good and well they aren't going to do it themselves, but they think the preacher ought to. Years ago, There was somebody here locally that was rather upset at one of the folks on the maintenance staff at the college, and began to speak their mind freely and not necessarily in a spiritual fashion. And then somebody came up and said, hey, Pastor Camp, what do you want me to do now? That's who was being addressed. And that person, their eyes got real big, and they said, oh, if I'd have known you were a preacher, I wouldn't have cussed at you. You know, what I'm trying to say is people have two different standards, you know, and they expect people in certain positions to hold a certain level of behavior, whether they hold themselves to that same standard or not. But here he says, be not many masters, or be not many teachers. Now, that means that I should resign from this and never be a Sunday school teacher again, right? It means it's bad to be a teacher. That means I should never teach my kids anything as a parent because, you know, I don't want to be held responsible for that. That's not the right application, but you know, there's plenty of people that would take it that way. Oh, well, then I'm just not going to do anything. I'm going to avoid accountability. You can't avoid accountability. It's just some like Demas, who was the one that loved the preeminence? What's the name I'm looking for? Huh? Demetrius? Huh? Diotrephes. There it is. Diotrephes, who loved the preeminence. You know, there's some that just want to have the position to be seen and heard. Okay? If that's your motivation, then understand that we will receive the greater condemnation. But at the same time, when God gifts and calls and puts you in a position of leadership, whether that's in a church or whether that's in a family, you cannot just shirk it because you don't want the responsibility. The caution here is to take that seriously. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. We're going to be judged more closely, if you will. And then there's a comparison. For in many things we offend all. Now, when we say offend today, we might think of, you know, saying something that hurts someone's feelings. I might look at Michael and say, I don't like your haircut. I did that with Michael because I know what Michael's going to say. I don't care what you think of my haircut. I like it, so it doesn't matter, you know. But, there's a reason I didn't use any of the ladies as an illustration there, because even as an illustration, I realize I may get, you know, struck with a lightning bolt, you know. But, you know, that to offend sometimes means to hurt someone's feelings, but that's not the way the word offend is used here. In verse number 2, in many things we offend all. The word offend here means to stumble, to trip, or to fall. So that same idea is used in other places where Jesus said, if you cause a little one to offend, in other words, if you're a stumbling block to them, you cause them to fall, then you're guilty. Here, what he's saying is, in many areas we all stumble, fall, you know, fall short of where we ought to be. That's the same word that's used again later on in the verse, but it says, in many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, there's the same word again, and it has the idea of to stumble or to trip, or, you know, in a greater sense, boy, they really had a big fall. It would be the idea of ruining or disaster. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. That word perfect, as we've already said, means mature. It's the same word in James chapter 1, verse 4, let patience have her perfect work. Same word in James 1, verse 17, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and cometh down from the Father of lights. It's the same word in James chapter 1, verse 25, when he says, whoso looketh into the perfect law of liberty, and continueth therein, he being not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this man will be blessed in his deed. So the idea is, so we have a comparison. If you want to be a perfect or mature man, a good example, if I go back to verse 1, a good teacher, one who can hold up to scrutiny, here's a good test. If any man offends not or stumbles not in word, the same is a perfect man and able also to bridle the whole body. All right, that phrase able to bridle means able to keep in check. All right, and that rolls right over into verse number 3 then. In verse 3 and following, we see the power of the tongue. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us. And we turn about their whole body. Okay, that form of phrasing here is very interesting. But we put bits in the horse's mouth. All right, any of you ever you've seen it up close, right? You may not have actually bridled a horse yourself, but you've seen it up close. All right, the bit typically is that metal bar that goes across a certain point in on the horse's jaw. All right, how does that bit guide a horse? I mean, well, I pull the reins and they go that way. Well, if they're trained and broken and submissive to that, that's the way it's supposed to work. But how does the bit and bridle actually work? You got it. Pain and pressure. You pull gently, it's pressure. If the horse still resists and you pull harder, it's pain, right? You want some good horse stories, Dr. Scoville can tell you a bunch of them. When he was younger, they did a lot of work with horses on the farm. And I have at times tried to, you know, draw some of those out of him, get him to tell you some of those. But he's exactly right. The bit produces pain. There's a particular spot in the horse's mouth where there's kind of an exposed gum, if I'm understanding it correctly. And the horse learns after a while, when I start to feel this pressure, if I don't do what they want me to do, the pressure is going to increase. And the more the pressure increases, it changes from just a push to pain. And the pain increases. Right? So the idea of a bit is, you know, that it is using pressure and pain to get the horse to go around. I say that, that'll come into play, you know, a little bit later on. But Proverbs says, "Be ye not as the horse and as the mule, whose mouth must be held in with bit and bridle." In other words, God said we're to be smarter than that, not have to be to the point where it takes pressure and pain to get us to obey, but rather to submit to the gentle urging and leading of the Spirit of God. But behold, we put bits in the horse's mouths that they may obey us. The word there for obey is not the word that I expected to find. Okay, I expected to find the word that's like, you know, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right, that kind of thing. That's not the phrasing here at all. The phrasing here is a verb that means to persuade or to convince. And it's a passive here, which means to be persuaded or to be convinced. All right, so we go back to the bit and bridle. Put those together, you get Brit, I guess, okay? But you go back to the bit and bridle. How do I persuade the horse to turn the direction I want him to go? With the pressure. And if they don't submit, well, then the pain. Okay? So the point here that he's, or the illustration that he's giving, is we use the bit to persuade the horse to do what I desire him to do, that they may obey us. And the last phrase is, and we turn about their whole body. I have from time to time observed some, you know, pretty small people riding a horse. That could be a child, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 years old. It could be an adult that just isn't all that large, you know. But you look at a 10-year-old kid, you know, you see sometimes, you know, kids that are in these competitions for various things, whether it's, you know, steeplechase or barrel racing or all those kinds of things. But you look at a 10, 12-year-old. Look at him standing beside the horse. The horse has him by a couple of pounds, don't you think? Or maybe 1,000 pounds. I mean, if that horse really, really decides he doesn't want to do what that rider's telling him to do, he could, you know, overpower the rider, right? But the horse has been trained and been, trained into them over a period of time that I must obey this stimulus, or it's going to be painful. And it's amazing. You can watch a 10-year-old take a 1,000, 2,000-pound horse and, you know, turn it whichever way they want to. I'm going to use Dr. Scoville's stories a little bit, but Dr. Scoville can tell you stories about when he was 9, 10, 11 years old, being put in charge of a wagon or a plow with draft horses, not just like riding horses that we would think of, but, you know, draft horses, the bigger ones. And you know, being responsible to run the wagon in the field or run the plows. I mean, here you got a 10, 11-year-old boy that's supposed to take these two big old draft horses and control them. And most of the time it works. But what's the illustration there? There's something of great power that if it's harnessed properly and pointed in the proper direction, it can be very effective and very useful. Doc, you ever seen runaway horse or runaway teams? He has. Okay. When they get to a runaway situation, that same thing that's very powerful and very helpful now all of a sudden is very dangerous. Could be life-threatening for people as well as the animals. But the illustration here goes back to verse number 2. If a man is able to guide and control and direct his tongue, then he has great power under control. All right, so that's the first illustration. The second illustration in verse number 4 is this. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. The ship, he says, behold great ships. That word great means large, or you know, great in size, which are driven about of fierce winds. You ever been on the water when that happens? It's not fun. I mean, it's one thing to be on the shore and the winds start whipping up and you can feel kind of the spray being in your face or that kind of thing. But to be on a boat when that happens. But it's true that if the big winds come up, it doesn't matter how big that boat is, it can kind of toss it around wherever it's going. And yet that huge ship that can be thrown around by fierce winds, what is the comparison here? What's the illustration? Yet are they turned about with a very small helm. That word turn about is the same word and phrase that we see in verse 3. We turn about the whole body of the horse. So in verse 4, they turn about the entire framework of a large ship. It says, yet are they turned about with a very small helm. That word helm there means rudder or a steering oar. Any of you ever gone canoeing, whitewater rafting? Have you ever been the one in the back, you know, and you've got that oar and you're supposed to do the steering? It's fun once you figure it out. You ever been in the raft or the canoe with somebody that's trying to figure it out and they don't know what they're doing? I have. Every year when we would go to summer camp, when I was a teenager, it was owned by a church in South Georgia, and they had a fellow in the church that had about 12 canoes. And he would bring those down to the camp on like Wednesday and Thursday every week. And there was a put into the river, you know, about 5 miles away or whatever. So they put everybody, bus everybody around, put them in there. And then we would canoe down and you could get off at the back edge of the camp property and just walk the trail back up, you know, to that. So yeah, I remember I learned after the first time, okay, I'm going to pick my partner for who's in the canoe very judiciously, very carefully. But, you know, if you know what you're doing, you can steer it. It's even more powerfully illustrated if you get in a whitewater rafting type raft. You get somebody at the back that knows how to take that paddle and which way to turn it to steer the boat. All right, I can go exactly where I need to go. Or if you get somebody that doesn't know what they're doing and the guide's in the next boat trying to tell them what to do and they're misunderstanding the directions, you end up going smack right on that big old rock. And you hope everybody stays in the raft and they don't, you know, tumble on out. But you can take a whitewater raft or a canoe, you can take that paddle, and, you know, it's a piece of wood or plastic about that long. I can stick it in the water and I can turn the whole thing. Same principle applies to huge ships. The size of the rudder compared to the size of the boat is very small. The rudder is very small compared to the overall size of the boat. And yet that rudder or that paddle, depending on the direction that it's turned, steers the entire thing. What's the illustration here? In verse number 3, what is the size of a bit compared to the size of a horse? You know, very small piece of metal compared to the size of a horse. What is the size of a rudder or that steering paddle compared to the size of a boat? A boat, I mean, what, 1%? know, maybe not even that, very small compared to the overall size. And yet in both illustrations, that very small piece steers something that's very large and very powerful. All right, you got the illustrations. All right, now we see the application. Verse 4, though they be great and are driven in fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. You know what that phrase means? That's not the way we would say it today, but basically it's wherever he wants to go, wherever the steersman wants to go. You ever been on a boat, and then whoever's driving the boat is going to let a kid have a chance to steer for a little bit? Maybe you're out on the open water, and you figure, okay, I think we can get away with this. They'd give the kid, today it would be a steering wheel, not, you know, the same kind of thing as you'd see on older models, but the kid gets a hold of the steering wheel and they start doing like this and they have to kind of steady it so you don't tip people off, but you can kind of tell who's steering the boat, right? But you know, you don't have any idea which way the kid wants to yank the steering wheel, but whichever way they want to yank it, that's the way the boat's turning because it's being guided by that rudder that's connected to the steering mechanism. In the same way, the helmsman of the boat, the captain of the boat, whoever's manning the steering wheel, can turn the whole ship whichever way he chooses. Now, what's the application? Verse 5, even so. So here's the comparison. Thus, in the same way, even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. So now you have little things that have a big impact or a big influence, right? The bit is really small compared to a horse, and the rudder is really small compared to the size of the boat. Well, now, here's the application. The tongue is a little member. The word little there, if we transliterated it into English, it would be micro. All right? The tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. You know, we just this week here in Cleveland County, there was a burning ban that was lifted. But in our county here, prior to Thanksgiving, you know, prior to Thanksgiving week here, in the last two and a half months, we might have had an inch and a half of rain. Inch and a half, 2 inches of rain in 2.5 months. It was extremely dry. And so eventually they put a burning ban on, which means no open fires, no campfires, no burning the leaves, which a lot of times happens this time of year when they start to fall, that kind of thing. It was a total ban. Why? Because the fire marshal knows that it doesn't take much to create a big mess. And when the situation's right, it can spread easily. I went to Google it just because I couldn't remember all the exact time frames, and it was longer ago than I thought. But it was actually back in 2016. There was a fire about 20, 30 miles from here at South Mountain State Park. Any of you remember that? South Mountain State Park. And that I never heard for sure if it was somebody's campfire that got out of hand or how the fire got started. But there was a fire that got started on the side of South Mountain. And it was spreading and they were working on it, on containing it and all of that. But that fire spread. From where we live, if you just go out to our street and look the proper direction, you could actually see the smoke coming up from off the side of the particular mountain where the big fire was. But I looked it up, and that fire in 2016, over the several days, you know, the period, it took them a period of time to get it contained, and they did, you know, what's been done for a long time. They would bulldoze a patch so there's nothing but dirt, and then they would kind of start a fire at that edge and have it burn back to the middle so it would burn out, you know. But even with all the work that they did to contain it and all of that, that fire over a period of, you know, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks, however long it burned, consumed 6,000 acres. 6,000 acres. All started from a campfire, which started from probably in one of those clicker things, or maybe a strike-type match. Little spark, little bitty fire on a candle, a match, whatever, to light a campfire that eventually lights a forest fire. Just because I'm curious about those kinds of things, I punched into Google what are the largest wildfires in history, and that 6,000 acres wouldn't make anywhere near the top list, even though it, in my mind, it did. You know, probably for most of you where you live, that fire at South Mountain that, you know, ended up being 5,000 or 6,000 acres, the smoke covered this area for a few weeks. You know, at one point in time when it was really bad, we were kind of trying to cover over any cracks in the doors or windows so it didn't come in the house because it would make you cough even in the house. Couldn't go outside for a few days because there'd be ash floating in the air. We saw that again recently. Then there were big fires up in Canada and some of the weather systems brought it down this way. But to me, that was a huge fire. Did a lot of damage. We went up there to look at the hiking trails, and it's just like, you know, charred everywhere. 2 years later, it was incredible. It was as green, and, you know, it came back with a vengeance. In fact, the wildlife people will tell you that that was actually good for it in some ways. Cleaned out some of the dead stuff, and the new growth is stronger and healthier and all of that. Little forestry management and, you know, true wildlife conservation principles there too. But the point is that that fire, to me, that I thought was enormous and had, you know, the biggest impact of anything I had really observed, didn't register on the needle at all. The top five, according to the list that I found, number five on the list was a fire in Australia a long, long time ago that burned 5 million acres. 5 million acres. There was one in Alaska about 19, 20 years ago that burned 6.6 million acres. In 2014, there was one in Northwest Territories in Canada that was over 8 million acres. And then the top two were one from 100 years ago, 1919 and 2020. But the Australian bush, there was bushfires that affected 42 million acres. And then there's one in the Siberian region of Russia that took out 55 million acres. I mean, that's the size of some countries. That's larger than entire states in the United States. And, you know, that fire that was 55 million acres, they said some of that was man-made, like campfires that got out of control or whatever during a drought in the summertime. Where did that campfire start from? You know, somebody struck a match. You know, somebody had a little means of getting a spark. They had one of those fireplace lighters or whatever. They got a small fire started, and the small fire gets a little bigger, gets a little bigger, gets a little bigger, and the wind and the dry material, and then it's completely out of hand. That is a comparison here in verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. And in verse 5, behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. So in verses 4 and 5, you have illustrations of small things that have a big impact. The bit for the horse, the rudder for the ship, and then the application to us, to the believer, is made. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. Verse 6, and the tongue is a fire. Now, what I just described with wildfires, is that what we would call a positive effect of fire or a negative effect? It's a negative effect, okay? If we talk about a house fire, is that a positive effect or a negative effect? So there's a lot of ways in which fire can be destructive. Is fire always bad? How many of you rode in a vehicle of some kind to get here today? All right, there was fire in a controlled setting inside that engine to propel the car to get here today. You know, spark plugs, okay. There's fire there. How many of you have a fireplace at your house? I know a few of you do. I mean, when it's cold, you like sitting by the fireplace, right? You get the fire going. That fire is a blessing. It's warmth. It's enjoyable. For those of you that don't have an indoor fireplace, we have an outdoor fireplace. We call it a fire pit. Okay? And even if I don't need it for the warmth, there are times when, okay, it's too hot. I don't want to sit close enough to the fire. I can feel the heat. I want to sit far enough back. I just want to watch the fire because it's fun. It's relaxing. But are those uses for fire harmful? No, those are positive. Those are favorable. And you know, there's a lot of other ways in which fire can be used properly. How do we refine metals? You build a fire up to sufficient heat to melt it down and refine metals. How do we shape things? This morning on the way into church, we were behind a pickup truck. And on the back, on the tailgate of the pickup truck, they were advertising ferrier services. That's not carrying people across a body of water on a boat. Rather, this was, you know, those that put shoes on horses. Okay, that kind of a ferrier. What does it take to get the horseshoe shaped properly? Usually it's going to take heat to soften the metal enough to shape it where it needs to go, or it's going to take an extreme amount of hydraulic pressure or some other kind to bend it and shape it the way it needs to be. But what I'm saying is there's heat that's used for all kinds of things. If you have anything that you use that's plastic, there was something that was, you know, brought to great heat to melt it down and then shape it and mold it and cool it down and all of that. Plastic, metal, you name it, you know, heat was necessary. Fire is not always bad, is what I'm saying. But when is fire destructive? When it's out of control? When it's not guided and controlled and held in check? I mean, if you have a setup to melt down ore, there's going to be containment, right? There's going to be non-flammable chamber where the fire is contained, and then the heat is channeled to melt what you're trying to melt. The point is this, fire isn't all bad, but here in verse number 6, when it says the tongue is a fire, it can be very dangerous if it's not applied correctly. If it's a fireplace and warmth is needed, that's a good use of fire. Okay, if it's a campfire that's not tended or lit when it's too windy and the conditions are poor for that, you could start a forest fire, all right? Well, then that's a bad effect of fire. Here in verse 6, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members that it defileth the whole body and setteth on fire the course of nature, and it is set on fire of hell. Now, it's pretty strong language, isn't it? What does that mean? All right, best I can explain it simply, I think it means this. The fire, hell was intended for who? The devil and his angels, Satan, exactly. Okay, hell was intended to be the place of punishment for Satan. Okay, now Satan enticed and tempted man. Eve, the Bible says, was deceived. Adam sinned willfully, and Romans says, wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin. So death passed upon all men for all have sinned. Adam chose to sin and brought sin on all of us. But that sin nature that's inside of us, in the middle of the verse, it says it defileth the whole body. Sin is described as defilement. Well, that sin nature that's in all of us, is that fire was started with the intended at residence of hell. That is that sin nature. Okay, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So the natural temptation, if you will, to use the tongue is for sinful purposes. Okay, why? The Bible says we're all born sinners. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. We're all born with a sin nature. Okay, so even when we talk about believers, we talk about, you know, the new nature or the new man, but then there's that battle between the flesh and the spirit that's described in several places in the scripture in different ways. But then what comes naturally to the flesh? All right, let me give you an expression here. If I were to say this expression, now let me just give you a piece of my mind. Do you expect that the next things that come out of my mouth are going to be spiritual? Or is that going to be fleshly? More than likely, that phrase is not going to be followed by calm spiritual advice. A lot of times that is grown out of frustration or anger, and then what comes out comes out of our flesh, our sin nature. It is our fleshly nature to just say things that are harmful, hurtful, painful, critical, whatever. That is the natural tendency. Now, what does fire do naturally? Does fire control itself naturally? It just finds whatever it can to consume to keep itself alive, and it'll just go as long as there's something to feed the fire. If a fire is contained, That has to be done intentionally, right? Same thing's true of the tongue. If you do not intentionally guard and contain and hedge in and direct the tongue, the natural outgrowth is going to be a forest fire. The natural outgrowth is going to be a grease fire that burns the skin, causes damage to a home, or in a larger sense, you know, damage to a community. That's the comparison here. So what is the power of the tongue? Well, number one, we see here the tongue has the power to steer, just like a bit or a rudder. So how does my tongue steer? I move my tongue left, right, up, down. It's not steering me. All right? Have you ever, in a flash response, said something, and then as soon as you said it, you realized you just committed yourself to something? It might be that, you know, you foolishly threw out a challenge, and now you either have to look foolish or you have to live up to the challenge. Maybe you, you know, committed yourself to helping in some way, but you can say something, it happens all the time. You say something and now, I've just committed myself to a certain direction or to a certain activity. Your tongue, if not guarded, will steer you. It can steer you around the rocks and safely down the river, or your tongue can steer that whitewater raft straight into the rock and bounce everybody out of it and into the water. The tongue can be like a fire in a fireplace that's hedged in and watched carefully, and it brings warmth and enjoyment. Or it can be that fire that gets outside the fire pit and burns the yard and threatens to burn down the shed and the house and everything else. The tongue has the power to steer. If you don't guard your tongue, you're going to get yourself in trouble. Whether you're going to commit yourself in, you know, young men and sometimes not so young men tend to say things, and now I've committed myself to some sort of a macho fulfillment that I probably should have just kept my mouth shut. Or the perfect man or the mature man, the one who is submitted to the Spirit of God, is the one that has learned how to guard and harness and guide and direct that so that it brings warmth, it brings encouragement, it brings comfort, and it doesn't bring destruction. It doesn't commit me to dumb things. It doesn't commit me to sinful things. It doesn't, the tongue, but rather, I am in control of that. You cannot control your tongue without the help of the Spirit of God. Okay? Now, I'm kind of getting ahead of myself because we've got to wrap this up for today. We'll come back and pick this up next week. But you cannot control the tongue without the help of the Spirit of God. So that's why in verse number 2 and 3 and 4, the comparison is made. One who is mature, one who is evidencing spiritual growth, one who is submitting to the Holy Spirit of God. You can see it by the way that they use, or if I could say it this way, don't use their tongue. If a tongue is under control, that is an evidence that the entirety of a person is submitted to the Spirit of God. Use correctly, steering's a good thing. Used correctly, fire's a good thing. Used carelessly, you can steer into a ditch, a telephone pole, a rock, and a fire can consume and have a lot of damage. God help us to have tongues that are submitted to God and used for good. Thank you, Lord, for your word.